John probably doesn't know who I am, and that's fine. But I heard him speak at the Marietta Roundup about 5 years ago, give or take. And he also spoke here at one of our first Fridays. And what stood out to me, a couple things, was he was funny, and his jackets. And I want to say the one from the Marietta Roundup, I was racking my brain trying to remember it, but it was very bright, very ornate. And y'all are laughing. He's got, from what I understand, he's got many. So, but I really, really enjoyed his story, and I think y'all will too. When Eddie said who the speaker was, I was like, I don't know if I know him. He's like the jackets. I was like, oh yeah, I know who he is. So, without further ado, I am gonna turn this over to John, and he will talk all about it. So you can.
Thank you very much.
Hey everybody, John Shires, alcoholic. I'm also qualified to call myself a drug addict. I was listening to all the different possible groups of people who were here tonight, and I was thinking, you know, behavior disorder? Yeah, I'm qualified for that. A lot of people would say, you know, the mental illness, sure. Unbalanced, definitely. Let me just say about the jacket thing real quick, because I know that's what everyone's thinking of. It's the jacket guy. So I'm a Hawaiian shirt and jeans guy. I'm pretty casual in my life. I'm a scientist. I'm retired now, but I was a scientist. And in the laboratory, I'm wearing jeans and a Hawaiian shirt just my whole life. And my wife, who is one of us and has been sober in this program a long time, said one year at Christmas, she got me a jacket. Not this particular one, but one. This is the fifth jacket, okay? Five Christmases, five jackets. 5 years ago, she said, baby, you don't look like yourself when you're speaking, because I came from a line of sponsorship where you wear tie and coat when you speak, you know. Like, I went and spoke one time at this meeting, and I went over to my sponsor's house right after it. I had only been being sponsored by this guy for, like, a few months, and he goes, where's your jacket and tie? I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, didn't you just come telling your story? I'm like, yeah. He goes, you didn't wear a jacket and tie? And I was like, dude, it was the gay clubhouse. It's super casual over there. And he's like, I don't care if you speak in a leper colony, you're going to wear a tie. So, you know, and he's been dead a long time now, but I still wear a jacket and tie in honor of him. But my wife would say, you don't look like yourself, you know, because it'd always be a black suit, you know, or a navy suit or something. So that's where this whole thing started. And it's a progressive illness, like alcoholism. It keeps getting worse. This is the loudest one I got, you know, so I figured I'd go full-fledged tonight. My sobriety date is March 7th, 1989, and I came through this treatment center, actually. So I guess I am an alum, you know. It was a very different guy who walked in here all those years ago. and I kind of get to that. My home group is the Fifth Tradition Group, which is an AA group. It's on the other side of town over in the Chamblee area. We meet Thursdays and Saturdays. We have a big book study on Thursday nights at 7 p.m. and a big speaker meeting on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. And I love my home group. Having a home group has been a central and instrumental part of my long-term sobriety. Like a lot of us, I'm a guy who doesn't naturally do very well at connecting with people, you know, and having a home group where I'm, you know, showing up and cooperating and trying to, and, you know, and being a part of something, having unity with other people and having relationships that I sustain over time has been a huge, huge thing for me. And it's been my home group, you know, ever since we started that group about 13 years ago. I told you my sobriety, I have a sponsor. That's another really important thing for me that I want to, you know, just emphasize. And actually, I want to say this. I have a sponsor who knows that he's my sponsor, which is a really important distinction, because some of y'all are laughing because I know you did what I did when I was new in this program. I got a sponsor because I'm a quick study. Look, I'm a phony and a fake and a fraud, okay, by nature. And so I pick up real quick on stuff. You know, if I don't know the prayer you're saying after three meetings, I've learned it, and now I say it with you. You know, oh, you come in, you say I'm an alcoholic, I say I'm an alcoholic. You know, I don't know what that means, but I am one. You know, it's no mystery why so many alcoholics are in sales, right? Because we're such good bullshitters, you know, and we can just sell it, you know. And so I come in and I'm hearing the lingo and I'm picking up the nonverbals and I'm like, oh yeah, I gotta have a sponsor. So I asked this guy, actually at the behest of one of the counselors here, I was a white van guy. All right, we got white van people in the room, you know, you get in the white van and you go to the meeting and all that kind of stuff. Well, and you fight over who gets to sit up front because they get to control the radio. Well, so we're at a meeting one night, one of the counselors was like, that guy'd be a good sponsor. And it was this guy, Ernie Cook, who's dead now, from the Skyland Group back in the day. So this is, yeah, 89. And so I went up to Ernie and I said, hey man, I'm looking for a sponsor. Would you be my sponsor? He said, absolutely. Here's my phone number. Call me and I'll be your sponsor. I called him one time. And then forever after, I told everybody he was my sponsor, but I never called him again. Because again, I'm a phony and I know what I need to do to fit in, you know, and I've been doing that my whole life, okay? It's an outgrowth of my self-centeredness. I'm just naturally a self-centered guy who just thinks about my appearance and how your perception of me is going, and I just act accordingly. So anyway, I have a sponsor who knows me. This is my sponsor. I actually talked to him today because someone called me and said, would you lead the discussion at this late night meeting at this clubhouse? And the truth is I'm 52 years old. I don't want to go lead the discussion at a late night meeting at a clubhouse anymore. And so I texted my sponsor, hey, I don't want to go lead the discussion at this late night meeting at this clubhouse. But that's not a good enough reason, is it? And he said, nope. So I'm leading the discussion at the late night meeting at the clubhouse. Anyway, I came in here, so back up, I'm from a big, gregarious, I love my family, okay, but I would not have told you that when I was new. I would have told you my family was terrible. They were sick and demented and twisted and terrible and effed up, and, you know, I have 7 brothers and sisters, half of us are alcoholics, drug addicts of some kind, the other half are trying to qualify, and I had come from a long line of alcoholics on both sides, and there was a ton of marriages and divorces. You know, between my wife and I, there's 8 marriages and divorces between our parents, and somehow we've managed to stay married for 26 years, despite the fact that we're 2 alcoholic knuckleheads. But I came up in this big, but it's a great family. Let me just say that I love my family. They're fun loving, they work hard, they party hard, and they're goofy, and they're funny, and they're smart, and they're eccentric, and they're weird, just like me, and everything except the smart part. But I came up in this family, and I never felt like I fit there when I was a kid. You know, I brought all this into recovery with me. I never felt like I fit anywhere, by the way, as a kid. You know, I was good in school, smart. I could take your tests and make straight A's on them just by sitting in class and listening. You know, but I never did any homework because I rebelled. I was like, they started homework in the 3rd grade. Okay, so up to the 3rd grade, I had straight A's. Then they introduced this whole idea of homework, and I was like, no way. I have to be here from 7:30 to 3:30, and I'm not taking a book home. That's my time. I'm not doing your shit on my time. I'm just not. And, you know, so I started seeing shrinks and doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists. I come from a fairly well-to-do family. And when you're screwed up as I am, always was, I mean, from a young age, you get to see lots of shrinks and doctors and stuff. And so I've been seeing people all my life. And no one could ever understand, how come this kid, he's so smart, and he gets straight D's in school, and he just barely scrapes by. And I'm a barely scraped by type of guy. We'll get into that some more down the road. But I never fit in school, okay? I didn't fit with the smart kids or the nerdy kids or the jocks or the anybody's. You know, I was good at sports. I played baseball and football growing up. You know, I was fast. I had good eye hand and, you know, I could do stuff. But I didn't fit with the jock kids either. I was raised in church. I was raised as a Presbyterian, which is, I don't know if there's any Presbyterians in the room, you know, but it's pretty mild religion, right? Right? It's not like hardcore, like fire and brimstone church, right? I mean, it's so mild. I tell people I was raised Presbyterian, but I believe in God anyway. So I was raised in church, but I didn't fit with the church kids. I just, I was raised in, youth group and confirmation classes and Bible study, and I sang in the choir. I was very involved in church as a kid, but never fit there either. So I didn't fit in my family. I didn't fit. So where do you fit? Well, I discovered at the age of 13 where I fit. I got drunk, and I've been drinking. I'd had sips off drinks. I'm big drinking family, you know. I have seven brothers and sisters, like I said. Five of them are older than me. Like, my nearest oldest sibling is like 9 years older than me, and then there was a bunch of older than her. So they were living with us half the time. They'd be drinking, and my dad drank, and everybody drank, and we'd watch the Super Bowl, and I could take a sip off my dad's beer and that kind of thing. I don't count that as drinking. You know, that's just like, well, I don't know, whatever. It's just, you know, it's a beverage at that point. I don't drink alcoholic beverages, you know, I drink booze. And but at 13, I went out with some older kids in the neighborhood and got drunk. And that's when I found where I fit. You know, I fit for the first time ever. So here's how my mind works. In our big book, it talks about in our inventory process, right? In the fourth step. There's three areas that it talks about: resentment, fear, and sex conduct. Okay, and they wouldn't have singled out those three areas if those three areas weren't big, big, big areas for guys like me. So the fear part, I was so grateful when I finally got a sponsor who kind of walked me through that, because I have been living in fear my whole life, and I didn't realize that it was fear. You know, so here's how it looked when I was like, you know, a teenager or a young kid. You know, somebody says something funny. And I think, I'd like to say this. Should I say that? I don't know if I should say that. Maybe it doesn't really gel 100% what they said. You know, no, it totally gels. It's totally funny. You should totally say it. It's the funny thing that goes with the other funny thing. No, don't say it. They might think you're stupid. You know, okay, then I say it. And now 25 seconds have gone by since the first thing got said. And now it's a total non sequitur. It doesn't fit in any way, shape, or form. Everyone looks at me. I'm like, I knew I was going to. You know, and this is my whole life, guys. This is my whole life, how it's been. You know, I overthink and underbehave. Okay? I overthink and I underact all my life. You know, I'm a nut job. So I'm always one step behind, one beat off, a little bit out there, you know, and no one knows exactly what to think. But I got drunk that 13 years old, first time, and that went away. If it came into my head, I said it. And it worked. It was funny, you know what I'm saying? Or it was appropriate to the conversation. I could come out and play. I was not, the chains fell off. I was not inhibited in any way. What I thought is what I said and what I did and blah, blah, blah. And it was awesome. Of course, that first night was just like a snapshot of what it was going to be like basically from there on. I got completely over, I mean, so I was 13 years old. I drank two quarts of Mickey's Mean Green Malt Liquor. That was my first drunk. There were four of us. We had eight quarts. We all drank two. Went to the movies, some Eddie Murphy movie, and we're in the Eddie Murphy movie. And the last thing I remember, everything after this is just like vague snapshots. But the last thing I consciously remember was leaning back in my seat and urinating over the seat in front of me. And thinking that was hysterical. And my friends thought that was hysterical. But the rest of the movie-going public did not think that that was hysterical. And it caused a big ruckus. And we ended up running out of the movie theater, out the side door, not finishing the movie. And just, I remember running through the parking lot, still trying to zip up my fly, laughing hysterically. Like, ha ha, that was so fun. That was so outrageous, you know. And then later that night, got sick, puked up all of my friends' parents' living room. Their couches, like fabric couches and carpet, and just made a mess. And then the next morning, they were pissed off, and my parents were informed, and the other kids' parents were informed, and now I'm like ousted by this little group because I'm the loser who can't hold his liquor, and so I'm in trouble, and I'm grounded, and I'm whatever. I don't know what happened at 13 years old. Like my Atari was taken away, you know, and my allowance was taken away, and you know I was in trouble, and. But I was like, and I was hungover, and I was very sick the next day. But the takeaway for me from that first night of drinking was, this is the greatest thing ever, and when are we doing it again? And it was like the next weekend, you know. I was never one of those, at least in the early days, I never said, I'm never doing this again. It's funny, because I've gotten to interact over the years with a whole lot of non-alcoholics. And that kind of experience is not actually that unusual. Even amongst non-alcoholics, right? A lot of kids do something stupid, and they get drunk, and then they say, this is what's unusual to me. They say stuff like, man, I learned my lesson that night. I never did that again. And they didn't. And I have a totally, see, part of me being an alcoholic is I have a very special relationship with alcohol, you know? And it does something for me that it doesn't do to non-alcoholics. It frees me in a way it doesn't free non-alcoholics. Non-alcoholics drink for some of the same reasons that I drink. It does loosen you up. It does do all these kind of things. But it's not like an absolute, for me, it's a religious experience, you know, especially that first time. And I was like, I am on this. I am on this forever. Let's roll. And my, you know, for the first few years that I drank, it was all just stolen liquor from all of the, you know, I grew up in an upper middle class neighborhood in South Tampa. And fortunately, or unfortunately, I grew up with a whole lot of other potential alcoholic kids. And everyone's parents had liquor cabinets. Everyone's garages had like 10 cases of beer for the, you know, for the pregame on Sunday kind of thing. And so we stole beer and we stole booze and we shoplifted beer and booze too from like the local 7-Elevens and stuff like that. So it's all like just stolen liquor, stolen beer, and it was like kind of thing where you get a container, a cup, or a jar, and you pour, you know, you go to the liquor cabinet and you pour an inch of vodka, and an inch of cream de menthe, and an inch of vermouth, and an inch of scotch, and you know, just this concoction, this cloudy, disgusting concoction, and then you run off in the woods, you know, and then you pass it around, you know, and you drink it, and you say really cool things like, man, that's smooth, bro, you know. And then later we started smoking pot, and then we started, you know, popping. And then one of my friend's parents, his dad sold pot, and so we used to steal his pot, so we had all the stolen, we had the stolen pot connection. And then we started popping pills. there were a lot of neurotic housewives in the neighborhood who needed their mother's little helper pills. And so we started stealing those, and then in high school, it was just like we showed up and it was like, okay, who stole pills and who stole weed and who stole beer? And let's run down. There was a little golf course down the street from my high school. We would, with woods around it, we'd hang out in the woods. I did a lot of wood drinking in the early days. Hang out in the woods, smoke dope, pop pills, drink whiskey, whatever we had, and then go to school hammered. And then at lunchtime, we'd go back down to the place and get, you know, do some more. And so that was just sort of, my high school years were a blur to me. It was just a hookup. High school was a hookup. That was all it was. I didn't care. It's funny. I got expelled from this really nice high school. I ended up at the public high school where I wanted to be with all my degenerate friends. You know, and by this time, okay, like by 16, 17, I have like really long hair and I'm wearing nothing but like black heavy metal. It's like Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer guy, you know, skateboarding. You know, big time skateboarding, had a half pipe in my backyard, just drunk or stoned all day, every day. And I failed my junior year. And in my second junior year, halfway through, I just quit one day. I just quit. I just, you know, I got into a, actually, it was a little bit of like ego. I got into a, like a argument with the dean. Because he caught me like roaming the halls, just like long hair, stone guy, like, you know, roaming the halls like for the third time that morning, you know, and he's like, you're on suspension and blah, blah. I'm like, F you. I had like four or five of my degenerate friends kind of standing around. I was like, F you, man. I don't need your damn school. And he marched me down to the office and made me sign the little GED training classes sign up thing, you know, so that I could leave. He was super happy to be rid of me. And so I got my GED, and my old man, so I'm living with my old man at this time. And like I said, I have seven brothers and sisters, but my parents were divorced, so one of my brothers and myself are living with my father. And I kind of have to tell you a little bit about my old man. He's a Marine. He's an ex-Marine. Like, he fought in Korea. You know, he grew up, came from nothing. His old man was a drunk. His mother was a school teacher. You know, he came from nothing, knocked up his high school sweetheart, married her without telling anybody, joined the Marine Corps, and then went off and fought in Korea and did 4 years in the Marine Corps, came back. Every time he was on leave, he knocked her up again. So by the time that he went to college, he had four kids. He went to college on the GI Bill, finished in 3 years. By that time, he had five kids, went to medical school, University of Florida, had five kids living in campus housing with five kids, and going through medical school. And he did all of that, and you know, and then later, you know, became a doctor, started his own medical company, nonprofit, you know, big company. It's now 600 employees. Like so, super successful guy, super motivated guy, you know, driven, like hardcore, and just an amazing guy. I hated his guts, by the way. When I did my resentment inventory, my old man, number one, right at the top, hated him. You know, because he cheated on my mom, and you know, they got divorced, and it's because of that I'm so screwed up. And which, by the way, is not true. That was my story for years, and I lived by that story, but it was not true. I was going to be screwed up no matter, you know, people talk about the dysfunctional family, and say, yeah, I was the dysfunction in my family. But I, you know, whatever, that was my version, like I said, of my family and of my role in the family, and what happened to me has changed over the years that I've been here. You know, my perspective has shifted. So anyway, I'm living with my dad, I get kicked out of school, and he did really one of the greatest things he could have done. He kicked me out. He's like, you know, he just had that old school, like, you're an idiot, you know, and you're not gonna just like sponge off me and just live here and for free. Get out. You know, get out. Okay. So I did what all tough guys, heavy metal guys do. I went and lived in my mom's basement. And my poor mother was dealing with her stuff, because my mother was like an untreated codependent Al-Anon type, right? She was a nurse, and she took care of people, and she took care of her kids, and you know, enabled us, and blah, blah, blah. So she was still really stuck in that place. So I was just totally sponging off of her. And so I sponged off her for like a year, and then she kind of helped me get an apartment and get into, I got into junior college in Gainesville, Florida. And I was going to junior college, and I was going to make something of myself. And Bill's story in our big book, he says, I was going to prove to the world I was important. And I was going to prove to people that I was not the screw-up that they said I was. Because everyone said, John's a screw-up. John's a failure. He's never going to make anything himself. He's a ne'er-do-well, whatever. You know, he's a big, fat loser, you know. And I was not a big, fat loser. I mean, look, I'm amazing. I know in my heart that I am amazing, okay? And I just need to be able to prove that to people. My wife and I were both neurotic, and both in this program. We actually shared a delusion in common. I think that's one of the reasons we got together. We both had this delusion that one day a black limousine was simply going to pull up out of nowhere, and a guy was going to get at the back and say, you would be perfect in this film we're making, you know? And would you be interested in auditioning for this, for the lead role in this film about really cool people? And yes, I would, you know. But I had no plans, no goals, no designs, and I lived to drink and get high, and that's what I did. And so I'm living in Gainesville, Florida, and about a year into I lived in Gainesville for 1 year before I came to this institution. And in that year, I ended up living on the outskirts of town in this little ramshackle house, me and my degenerate roommate. I was a high school dropout. He had dropped out in the sixth grade. And you know, and I always thought, if I ever get as bad as Steve, you know, I might need to do something, but like, it would be hard to get worse than Steve. But you know, we were in a bad place. We were getting ready to be evicted from this house for having not paid rent for a couple of months. The utilities have been turned off one by one. And, you know, being a delusional type, I can kind of bullshit myself into thinking things were okay. Like, when the power gets turned off, bro, I live by candlelight, you know? I'm romantic, you know? I'm a romantic. And you can kind of do that kind of thing. Oh, by the way, stolen candles. Stolen batteries that operated our boombox, which we called our entertainment center. And but when the water gets turned off, reality kind of, you know, it kind of apply, you know, comes to, and so the water got turned off, and after that we weren't showering, we weren't brushing our teeth, and you know, we were just living like animals. We were disgusting. It was nothing but alcohol and drugs, and just this bare existence. And I just could barely get to work to you know, make the money that I needed. You know, I've kind of always been an amateur musician, and so I'd have guitars and amplifiers, and they'd be in and out of the pawn shops, and the only things of value that I had, and I would get my paycheck, and I would go get my guitar and amp out of the pawn shop, and come back to the house and get high and drink and play the guitar and think about how I'm going to be a rock star. And then, you know, by like Wednesday, I'd be back in the pawn shop. And, you know, this one guitar that I had that I actually brought to Ridgeview with me all those years ago had been in and out of the pawn shop like 10 times in the last 6 months before I got here. I way overpaid the value of the stupid thing. Anyway, the problem with water is this, is you still have to use the toilet, even if you cannot flush the toilet. And so we're living in this house, you know, using the toilet that we can't flush, and the house just stunk like human waste. You know, and the solution to this, which I thought was genius, is every night I would go into my neighbor's yard and get their garden hose and run it through the bathroom window, fill the tank up, and flush it. Now, in the big book, it says, the doctor's opinion, it says that alcoholics, as an alcoholic, I'm delusional. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. That I cannot differentiate the true from the false in my life. And that is so true. And it was years later that I put this together. You know, but my reaction to that, when I figured out the stolen water thing, was that is genius. You know, like a lot of guys couldn't even handle this. You know, a lot, like somehow it's like a badge of like, I'm a survivor, man. You know, like I am dealing with this terrible situation that others could not even come up with this stolen water gig, you know. And part of me too was like, I'm getting one over on society, you know. Like, I don't need your water company, you know. Like, I got my water, you know. Just like, just crazy, rebel without a clue kind of stuff. So it was about this time that my mother had said, look, I'd had a family member go to this treatment center right here to Ridgeview a year or so before. And it was like the only connection to any kind of recovery that anybody in the family knew. So my mom was like, why don't you go to this place and just see, you know. And I went, and I came here. And I did not come here because I thought I was an alcoholic or an addict or, you know, anything. I came because they had electricity and running water, and because I thought it was one more scam. It was like, I'll get back in my mother's good graces, and maybe I'll be able to sponge a little more money off of her, blah, blah, blah. So I came here for that reason. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me in here because, so I was doing all the treatment stuff, but at the same time, every night, or like three or four nights a week on the unit I was on, they would have, by the way, I was 19 years old, I was put on the adolescent unit because the doctor in charge tricked me into signing this, because once you're on the adolescent unit, you can't just leave. If you're on the adult unit, you can sign yourself out AMA and leave. But I was tricked onto the adolescent unit. So I was 4.5 months on the adolescent unit. And but 4 nights a week or something, AA members and NA members and CA members would come in and tell their stories. And that is what hooked me, because I can argue with, and I do, but counseling and the therapy and the psychological stuff, whatever. But when guys and gals were coming in here, I mean, I'm talking men and women, straight and gay, black and white, were coming in and telling their stories, and every single one of them, I was like, holy shit, I relate to that guy. You know, that girl knows what she's talking about. You know, these people were because they were sharing their stories, they were sharing their experience. And I knew what they were talking about. I didn't, look, no shortage of people have tried to help me, okay, in my life. I mean, guidance counselors, teachers, ministers, the youth pastor at the church, you know, my parents' friends. I mean, lots of people tried to help me, but there was always this one up, one down dynamic, you know, of like teacher and student, you know, or someone who's good helping someone who's bad, you know, kind of thing. And you guys weren't like that. You guys were just like, here's my deal. You know, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, this is the crazy stuff I've done, my life is totally unmanageable. Man, I connected with that. I connected with that. And so it didn't take long. I mean, like 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. I was like, I'm in. I'm in with these people. I did not fall in love with the 12 steps, and no one does. That is not the way it happens in this deal, my experience. I fell in love with the people, with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, not with your steps and your God and your higher power and your program and your service work and all this kind of stuff. So I fell in love with people, so I threw myself into it. And I, like I said, I was in here for 4.5 months, locked up, locked unit. No cigarettes, You know what I'm saying? Like, and then you would get leaves, and we'd get like an 8-hour pass and smoke a whole pack of cigarettes and come back sick. And then they would drug test you because they're like, why are you sick? Did you do drugs? I'm like, no, I just smoked 12 Marlboros, you know, in the last hour. So got out of here, did the whole thing, did the halfway house, the three-quarter house, the 11/16 house, the aftercare, the IOP, you know, the whole thing. So my whole first year, I was like, in some capacity, was associated with, you know, treatment and halfway house and all that. And but I started going to meetings, man, at 7 meetings a week, no problem, maybe 10 meetings a week, because I loved the fellowship. I loved the people. I fell in love with them. And the first couple of years that I was in AA, it was just all about, like, hanging out, man. You know, I'm 20 years old. Never took a legal drink in my life, by the way. 20 years old, coming in here, hanging out late night, going to the 8 p.m. meeting, then going to eat a hamburger, and then coming back for the 10 p.m. meeting, and then going to do this, and then going to shoot pool, and then going to an all-night dance club with like 25 sober young people, and like just hanging out and being wild and crazy. And my life was good. It was better than it had ever been. So I'm a high school dropout, had got a GED. I said, you know, the only job I could get was either waiting tables or delivering pizzas. And so I'm waiting tables and delivering pizzas, you know. By the way, every job that I had in my first couple years of sobriety, every single one, without exception, I quit in the middle of a shift. Because I was just like emotional. I'd get pissed off about something. I'd be like, I'm out of here. I can find a job as good as this in 45 minutes. Bah! You know, so I mean, this just kind of giving you a little picture who I was. So, but I decided to go back to school. I went to Kennesaw, which was a junior college at that time. This is like 90, 91. And so I'm going back to school. I'm working. I'm making money. I'm going to tons of meetings. I'm sober. I'm crazy, but I don't realize how crazy I am because my life is better than it's ever been, you know. And, you know, 2 years sober, I'd finished like 5 quarters at Kennesaw with a 4.0 GPA. Okay, I'm sober, I'm making good grades at school, I'm working, I'm making more. My parents are proud of me. They're like, they're just overjoyed. I cut my hair at some point. I don't know why I decided to cut my hair off, but I had really long hair. I cut my hair off, and my father, the Marine, was just like, that was all I needed to do for him. I cut my hair off. He's like, I will help you. Tell me what you need. So, like, things are getting good. So I applied to Emory University. I got accepted. Now I'm going to Emory University. So I'm not like, so I'm the high school dropout is going to Emory University, and I'm, you know, going to 7 meetings a week, and I'm living in the Highlands, and I've got, I'm making more money than I've ever made. I'm not spending it all on alcohol and drugs. So, you know, it goes a lot further. So I have a 1991 model year car in 1991. That's how good I was doing. And that's how vain I am. That's how pathetic and surface level I really am. You know, I'm like, I'm doing great because I have a, you know, a 91 car in 91, man. And I have a good guitar and a good amplifier. And I have a good apartment in the Highlands. And I'm going to Emory University. And I go to 7 meetings a week. And I know, you know, a couple of hundred people in Alcoholics Anonymous on a first name basis. And, you know, and by the way, I shared in every single one of those meetings. You know, whether I had a solution or I didn't have a solution. I was just totally crazy. I didn't have a sponsor. I'm not working any steps. You know, I'm just like, wah, sobriety, yeah! You know, and but I'm getting crazier and crazier and crazier. And I'll just tell you a little stint of there's about a few months. I couldn't tell you the truth about exactly when all these events happened. But they're all over a few months period of time. Because this is where my life was at like 2.5 years sober. So, by the way, I was sponsoring people, which is a really scary thought because, you know, I'm not so much carrying the message as spreading the disease at this point. And so I have a sponsee in the car. We're leaving the late night meeting at Triangle. I get pulled over for running a red light, and I get taken to jail. I never went to jail when I was drinking. Okay, I went to jail stone cold sober for driving on a suspended license because I had gotten so many speeding tickets and so many moving violations, and I had moved, you know, like, you know, this is really weird to me. I learned this like, with many years sober. Every time you move, you're supposed to get a new driver's license that has your current address on it. Did you know that's actually a law? I didn't know that. So I had moved like 8 times in my first 2 years of sobriety, and so I never got the notification that my license was suspended, even though I kind of knew in my heart it was probably suspended, you know, because that's, I'm delusional. I can operate, you know, on, I can take the facts and twist them and just, you know, just push that off to the side. And so I was totally shocked. And so my sponsee had to take my car and drive it home, which was lucky that they let him do that. And then my pregnant girlfriend, an AA, who was another AA member, had to come bail me out of jail the next morning at 4 a.m. So, and then she bailed me out of jail, and then she told me, you got to take these pills, because the doctor says I have this sexually transmitted disease, and you probably have it too, so we both have to take these pills for next month. So this is the kind of, this is where I'm at, you know? Just like it says in the big book. I think the chapter's called A Vision for You, you know? So I'm 2 years sober around there. I'm getting crazier and crazier and crazier. And this is, eventually I got so crazy I almost drank again. About 2.5 years sober, I'm ready to throw all the good stuff in my life away because I'm so crazy. And I don't know what's wrong. I'm going to 7 meetings a week. I have a killer program. That's what I thought. I'm going to 7 meetings a week. I haven't drank or done any drugs, and I'm going to 7 meetings a week. Isn't that a kick-ass program? And eventually I got a sponsor. I was like, I almost drank this one night. And I came back to my home group on a Tuesday, and I went up to the guy who I hated, and it's because he had this big book. You know, one of those guys, you know, under his arm, everywhere he goes, every meeting, you know, he goes into. And it's a dog-eared big book. It's got highlight, you know, underlined, everything. And it's got like letters from a men's hanging out of it, you know, and it's all this. And he talked about a men's and inventory and blah, 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 and prayer and meditation whenever he shared. But he was happy. He was like, he was very genuine. And, you know, I hated people who were doing better than me, which was mostly everybody. So anyway, I went up to this guy, and it was like a moment of clarity. I need to ask this guy to sponsor me. I need to do it. And I knew I had not done the steps. I mean, I knew in my heart I had not done the steps. And I heard this girl tell her story one night at the Skyline Group. I was about, I don't know, 2 years sober, so in this time frame. Anyway, she killed it from the podium, that girl. She was like on it. She was just like, her message was solid, man. She had recovered. She was getting better. She was moving on with her life. Things were going great, blah, blah, blah. And she was talking about these amends that she had made and over all these different amends and all these girls that she sponsored and, you know, in her home group and the service work that she was doing. And I was like, man, this girl must be like 10, 20 years sober. And then at the end of her talk, she said, and next month, I'm going to have a year. And I was like, bitch. You know, I was like, how dare you be doing so much better than me, you know? So somewhere in there I knew, you know. So anyway, I went to this guy and I said, look, I told him everything basically I just told you about the chlamydia and the jail and the pregnancy and the this and the that and the blah, blah, blah. And he says, dude, your life is unmanageable. He said, your life is unmanageable. You're 2 years sober and your life is unmanageable. And you are suffering from untreated alcoholism. And he said, look, he broke the big book out, like the good sponsor that he was. And I always love to read this, because this is what he read to me. And this is on page 52 in the big book. He said, John, he says, tell me if this just describes your life. He says, we're having trouble with personal relationships. I'm like, yeah, massive trouble in personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real use to other people. He says, does that describe your life right now? And I had read this. I had one sitting on the back of my toilet. And I had read the big book over and over and over again every morning. And I missed that. I missed most everything. Something weird happens to me. So subsequent to this, my sponsor and I, he would sit down, we would read the book together. And that's where I had this experience. There's the painting or the little artwork you see. And it, if you look at it, it's just black and white. And you look at it and it's a vase. And then you finally realize it's not a vase, it's like two people in profile, you know, but it looks like a vase. It was that kind of experience. Like I'm looking at this thing that I've seen a million times before, and I'm having a totally different experience with it. You know, and so I said, I have never worked the steps, and I'd love for you to do this. So I sat down with that guy, and we met once a week and for like 2 hours, and we would read the book, and then we started going to a big book study in his sponsor's basement. And this was a guy named Dennis Sanfilippo, who's been dead since 2004. And he had a big book study in his basement for like 30 years. And for 30 years, he just took guys through the book. That's all he did. He was just like a bastion of AA service. And it was like 40 guys and like a huge 100-cup coffee pot. And everybody smoked. This is back when everybody smoked indoors everywhere. And we sat in that basement and we smoked 4 cigarettes an hour. And we drank coffee, and we listened to the Joe and Charlie big book CDs, you know, cassette tapes, actually, at that time. And this is like 92, you know. So we're listening to Joe and Charlie cassettes, and then we'd read the book up to where they got, and then we would stop. And when we got to a step, we did the step. And when we had to got to write an inventory, everyone go write an inventory and bring it back here next week. And then we got to amends. Okay, we're going to go make amends and come back and tell our stories about making amends next week. You know, and so we just did it. We just went through the steps. In like 6 months, we went through the whole big book and all 12 steps for my first attempt, my first pass. Because it says in our book, right, try to be thorough and honest. And I look back at that first inventory that I'd written today, and I'm like, I don't know how thorough or honest I really was. But it was more thorough and more honest than I had ever been up to that point, you know, with myself and with some other human beings. And things started to change. Before I know it, I had a little group of sponsees, you know, and I was sitting down with them and reading the book. And by the way, my sponsor was really harsh. He was like, turn to the first page of the book. And I'm like, okay, first page, page one, Bill's story, page one. And he's like, no, the first page. I'm like, the first page? Back in this Roman numeral shit? You know, who reads that? You know, okay, the preface, you know the preface? No, the first page. Okay, like what, the title page where it says Alcoholics Anonymous? And he's like, no, the first page. I'm like, you mean this page? The open cover? Yeah, what does it say there? I'm like, nothing. He goes, that's what you know about staying sober, nothing. You know? I mean, I was like, I almost walked out of the room. You know? I was so insulted. And so we went through, started doing this, and that's really the, you know, when we talk about, we tell our stories. We tell what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And that's where the what I'm like now story starts. Because really, from that day to this, I have been very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look back now, and I realize before that day, I attended AA religiously. But I was not involved in AA. I had not done the 12 steps. This is the craziest thing maybe ever, right? To join a 12-step organization and do everything they tell you to do except for the 12 steps is crazy and delusional. Like, I was sitting in your meetings and not availing myself of this spiritual path that is the 12 steps. So whatever, I started on this journey at that point, and I've been pretty much involved from that point to this point. I mean, whatever I've been doing, I've been in AA. Whatever I've been doing, I have a home group that I don't miss. Whatever I've been doing, I have sponsees that I meet with, read the book with, help them with their inventories, help them with their amends, help them with their difficulties. My life is, you know, it's been up and down. Life is life, right? Just because I'm sober doesn't mean I'm going to not have problems. I'm not going to have difficulties. I'm not going to have, the economy's going to be great always, you know, that the jobs are going to be great always. No, that's not true. As it says in our big book, it says, this is a program that works even in rough going. It doesn't matter how bad it gets. The program is fine. The program works. So not long after that, I met my now wife. By the way, let me tell you this. So I had like 25 relationships in my first 3 years of sobriety. 25. You know, and most of those were not one-night stands. I mean, I'm a serial monogamist. You know, I am like a hostage taker guy. You know, I am like, she's the one. God sent her to me. I met her on my way to the coffee pot, you know. My sponsor, Dennis, by the way, I said something to that effect one day in a meeting. He was in, he pulled me aside afterwards. He goes, dude, God is not a pimp. Just want to clear that up for you, you know. But I had 25 relationships, and I did, you know, our inventory, and one third of the inventory is sex conduct. And so I went through all these relationships. and got some clarity on some really sick, you know, dependency stuff, you know, that I do, you know, that I need her. I am incomplete without her, except, oh, maybe I need her, you know? So I'm bouncing and bouncing around in all these relationships. And since I worked the steps, I've been in two relationships. The first one after I worked the steps was this girl who I really liked a lot. And she was not an alcoholic. She was super normal. In fact, she was so normal that in the end, I had to break up with her. Okay? And that woman is a judge today. And I think you can all agree, with the little bit you know about me, that I'm not the guy to be married to a judge. Okay? So made the right decision there. And then shortly after that, I met my wife at a young people's dance in Columbus, Georgia. And I was going down to do outreach for the International Young People's Convention that was coming to Atlanta. This was in 94, so this was in 93. So I met my wife, then she ended up moving up here, and then she had relapsed, which I didn't realize before she moved up here, because she was crazy too. But then she jumped in, and kind of that same group of people, but with the women in that group. And so she kind of got her act together, and we came together, and we've been together for 29 years and been married for 26. We just celebrated our 26th wedding anniversary this past May, which is unbelievable to me. And the two of us, like I said, between the two of us, we have like 8 marriages between our parents, 8 failed marriages, like none of them worked, you know? So we don't have any kind of role model, you know? We learned it all here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And then after I graduated from Emory, I got a degree in biology and I was gonna be a doctor. Then I realized I don't wanna be a doctor. I am way too eccentric and weird to be a doctor anyway. I can't, you don't want me as your doctor. So I was like, okay, I'll be a scientist. So I applied to a bunch of graduate programs, ended up getting accepted at Yale University, went off to graduate school at Yale University. My wife, you know, she was my fiance at the time, but she came with me and we got married. And then we lived there, had our first child there. Then, you know, one thing led to another. And then we ended up having to relocate during my training to London, England. We moved to London, England. We lived there 4 years, had a second child there, came back to the States, and had our third child here, who we had a, you know, real tragic situation where our daughter had a big stroke in the womb and had this massive brain injury. And it was a real trying, traumatic, difficult time that we had to go through around that. But AA showed up for us because we were in the middle of AA. When you're in the middle of AA and then suddenly some bad shit goes down, everybody's like, oh my God, what are we gonna do to help that person? Well, I've been on both sides of that. I've been the guy who's like moved in the meeting because I heard, oh my God, so-and-so's husband was killed in a drunk driving accident, and we go and we show up at that person's house and we bring food and we help them and we do whatever it is we gotta do. And if we need to raise money, we raise money. It just happens. It's amazing to see. Well, that happened to us. Like, you know, I had a wife in one hospital, an infant daughter in another hospital, and 2 little boys at home, and AA showed up and took care of us. People came to our house and brought us food, and they mowed our grass, and they, you know, cleaned the house, and they just did all this stuff for us. It was a really amazing, powerful thing. And my daughter, who is a special needs child, but is just like the best kid. I have 3 children. My 2 boys, I was just telling Jared, you know, before the meeting, and Peter, you know, my boys are 50-50. Whether they're going to be in here one day, right? They smoke dope like it's going out of style. They drink like fish. They're crazy. My one son's an actor. My other son works in a weed dispensary in Boulder, Colorado. You know, I mean, I love these kids. They're awesome. They're funny and they're smart and they're bright, but they're, oh God, they drive their mother and me crazy. Meanwhile, my 18-year-old special needs daughter is the easiest kid I have. And my wife and I jokingly say to each other often, why can't all our kids be special needs, you know? So you never know how things are going to shake out. Anyway, I'm getting basically run out of time here, but yeah, I mean, my life is good today. I have my ups and downs, like I've said, you know, but like, I'm still at the meeting on Thursdays and Saturdays. You know, I'm still sponsoring a shit ton of guys. I go to a lot of AA conferences and conventions, you know, all over the country. I mean, 20 of us go out to Vegas every December. For the second week of December, there's this big AA convention in Vegas. It's like the best convention ever, you know. And people say, God, like non-alcoholics say, God, you know, 20 alcoholics in Las Vegas? What the fuck would you do? You know, you're sober. Yeah, we had this killer conference, and we stay an extra day, and we go to see shows, and we go gamble in the casinos, and we have a good time, and it's freaking awesome. So, you know, it says in our book, we're not a glum lot, you know. We are not to be miserable. I'm happy, joyous, and free, or I'm not going to stay. And I almost missed all of this, because at 2.5 years sober, I was thinking, hey, it doesn't work. I've been going to 7 meetings a week for 2.5 years, and I'm going to kill myself, you know. I was miserable, you know, and I... that close. And thank God I had just that little bit of willingness to ask a guy to help me. And he said, I can help you. And he did. And then another guy's helped me, and another guy's helped me, and another guy's helped me. And I have remained sponsorable to that day. I just got a new sponsor a year ago because my sponsor got too old to sponsor me. I'm sponsoring him, you know. I mean, I'm just, it's all about, are you taking your pills, Jerry? You know, you know. I mean, so I need a sponsor. So I had to change. And my sponsor has less time than I have. But he's more busy in AA than I am. That's what I need. I need someone who's busier than me. And I can, someone called me today, I think I said it, asked me to lead discussion at the midnight meeting at this clubhouse. I'm like, God, I don't want to do that. You know, my sponsor's like, yeah, you got to do that. I texted my sponsor, do I have to do this? Yeah, you have to do it. You were asked, it's an AA request, you can't turn it down. Go do it. Plus, I'm 52 years old and I'm retired. You know, I don't even have a job anymore. You know, like I can't go out and do, I can go out and do it. So anyway, I appreciate you guys listening. My time is up. Thanks for letting me share.
John, thank you. It's as funny as I remember. Love it.